KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Maybe though we should not ask Trump, but Putin, what to do. This would cut out a middleman, right?
As President Trump echoes Kremlin talking points about Ukraine, Ukraine and its leaders react.
For Thursday, February 20th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The next agency in the crosshairs of the Trump administration, the IRS, where thousands of jobs are being cut this week.
If your goal is to save money and be efficient, this is not what any rational person would do.
And Senate Republican Mitch McConnell, one of the most influential lawmakers of the past half century, says he's retiring after this term.
Representing our Commonwealth has been the honor of a lifetime.
Plus, how Canada lost its dominance among hockey goalies.
First, these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The annual CPAC Conservative Conference kicked off today just outside Washington, D.C. As NPR's Stephen Fowler reports, an unannounced appearance of Elon Musk drew the most excitement.
After Musk took the CPAC stage, Argentina's President Javier Milei brought him a golden chainsaw to symbolize his work to slash the size, scope, and spending of the U.S. government. Musk hyped the idea of taking some of that savings identified by Doge and giving it back to taxpayers.
It's money that's taken away from things that are destructive to the country and from organizations that hate you.
But that idea is a long way from coming to fruition. An NPR review finds the Doge effort has overstated its savings claims so far by billions of dollars. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration has cut protections for hundreds of thousands of Haitians, putting them on track to be deported this summer. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, allows people from certain designated countries where there is armed conflict, environmental disaster, or political turmoil to live in the U.S. Among those nations is Haiti. Haitians have been designated as eligible to receive TPS since 2010. Around 500,000 Haitians living in the U.S. are eligible for TPS status. Before he left office, President Joe Biden granted them an extra 18 months of protection from getting deported. But Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has now signed an order revoking that extension. That means the temporary protected status will now expire in August of this year, putting hundreds of thousands on track for deportation back to Haiti. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
A series of explosions are being reported on buses tonight in central Israel. That's according to Israeli police. As NPR's Adil Al-Shalchi reports, it comes at a very critical moment in a ceasefire between the Palestinian militant group Hamas and Israel.
Israeli police said that there were no reported injuries after multiple explosions went off on buses in the southern Tel Aviv suburb of Bat Yam. Officials said the buses had finished their routes and were in a parking lot. Israeli police said they were investigating the incident and that explosives were found on two other buses. This comes hours after the Palestinian militant group Hamas returned the bodies of four Israeli hostages. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News.
While the world's largest retailer delivered another year of strong sales and profits, the outlook for the year ahead is a bit less rosy. That contributed to a major down day on Wall Street. Retailer Walmart projecting its forecast for this year could be below analyst expectations. Company officials citing a possible pullback in consumer spending and higher prices due to proposed tariffs by the Trump administration on China. The Dow fell 450 points today. The Nasdaq was down 93 points. You're listening to NPR. Looking to avert a possible confrontation, top EU trade officials have been stressing the importance of active engagement and fairness between the bloc and the U.S., though how things will shake out remains to be seen. President Trump continues to throw decades-long partnerships between the U.S. and Europe into turmoil as he talks about ramping up tariffs, something that would make the price of imported goods higher for U.S. consumers. It's not clear whether the EU would impose retaliatory measures of its own. A new study finds lab mice may try to revive unconscious mice when they see them. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert explained, some researchers suspect it may be a form of empathy.
Researchers who anesthetize mice have noticed that other mice sometimes behave strangely towards unconscious individuals. New research published in the journal Science describes this behavior in detail. When presented with an unconscious cage mate, mice exhibit behaviors that start with sniffing and grooming and progress to biting and even tongue pulling. Mice are especially attentive when they know the unconscious mouse. The poking and prodding actually seems to help the knocked out mice regain consciousness faster, the study found. These behaviors were activated by oxytocin circuits in the brain, which have been shown to underlie helping behaviors in other species. The researchers say it could be an instinctual behavior that might have evolved because of its beneficial effects to social groups. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices closed higher today, adding to recent gains. Oil up 32 cents a barrel to end the session at $72.57 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at GundFoundation.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. For the past 3 years, the U.S. has been Ukraine's leading supporter in its war with Russia. But with a series of stunning moves, President Trump is now sounding more aligned with Russia than with Ukraine. To break this down, we are joined by NPR's Greg Myrie in Washington and Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Hey to both of you.
Hello.
Hi, Scott.
Greg, I want to start with you. Trump is publicly attacking Ukraine's president. Why? Why is he doing this?
Well, Scott, Trump has been critical of Ukraine and Zelensky dating back to his first term, but we've never seen language this harsh. Writing on social media, Trump said, quote, "A dictator without elections, Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left." So in the past week, Trump has also reached out to Russia, which had been isolated under the Biden administration. Trump called Russian leader Vladimir Putin and senior Trump aides met with their Russian counterparts in Saudi Arabia without Ukraine present. And this all seems to be part of Trump's very aggressive campaign for a ceasefire. And he's going about it by putting very intense public pressure on Ukraine and Zelensky, who are in a vulnerable position on the battlefield.
Joanna, how are people in Ukraine responding? Specifically, how is Zelensky responding?
So Zelensky has remained calm and he's tried to be diplomatic. And he seemed concerned, not angry, when he said yesterday that President Trump seems to live in a Russian-created space of disinformation. Trump is repeating Kremlin talking points. He's blaming Ukraine for the war, even as Russia continues to attack the country every night. And he's claiming Zelensky is an illegitimate president. And now Ukrainians are, you know, they very much want this war to end, but they've been watching the Trump administration's actions with disbelief. We spoke to several Ukrainians who are outraged by Trump's comments. Olena Tokovenko, she's a 47-year-old lawyer, she said Trump is acting like he owns Ukraine. Maybe Trump can just tell us who to elect and maybe even offer his own candidate? Maybe, though, we should not ask Trump, but Putin, what to do. This would cut out a middleman, right? Because this is Russia's policy coming through Trump. The feeling that the White House is aligned with Russia is so shocking to Ukrainians because they have staked their very survival as a country on Western-style democracy and liberty, which they believe the U.S. was a beacon of.
So Trump is attacking Zelensky, echoing Kremlin talking points. Zelensky is responding. But Joanna, at the same time, Trump's envoy for Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, is in Kyiv. How is he being received?
Well, Scott, he's here this week, but it's really not clear how much authority he has. And this point seemed to be driven home today when we went to the presidential palace for another press conference, this time with Kellogg and Zelensky. But while we were waiting to sit down for this press conference, Zelensky's spokesman said it would not happen at the request of the American side.
Okay, so Greg, what is likely to happen with U.S. military support for Ukraine? It's billions and billions of dollars.
So for the moment, it continues. This is part of a big package approved last year by the Biden administration. It's still working its way through the pipeline, but it is winding down, and Trump is giving no indication that he'll seek more. In fact, just the opposite. He says Zelensky's great skill has been to get the U.S. to send him money, and suggesting that there won't be more going to Ukraine. Now, the Europeans are helping with their own military assistance, but without American aid, the Ukrainians will be stretched very thin. For example, Ukraine needs regular resupplies of air defense missiles to shoot down these daily and nightly Russian airstrikes.
Question for both of you. Trump really seems to be in a hurry here to get ceasefire negotiations started. What are the various parties? We're talking Trump and America, Ukraine and Russia. What do they want from these talks? Greg, let me start with you.
Yeah, I spoke with Andrew Weiss at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. He says Trump wants this ceasefire, but doesn't seem particularly interested in the details. He said Russia is also interested in a ceasefire, but has very expansive and ambitious aims.
The Russians are pressing for a big ceasefire, and that ceasefire would include caps on the size of Ukraine's military. It would impose strict limits on Western cooperation with Ukraine, and it would close the door to Ukraine's membership in NATO.
Joanna, what about Ukraine?
So, Scott, Ukraine wants very strong security guarantees to protect itself from Russia, to avoid more invasions in the future. And Zelensky says he will not give up Ukraine's push for NATO membership or its wish to get back territory occupied by Russia. And Ukrainians, they also want Russia to be held accountable for war crimes. But with the Trump administration, all this is up in the air.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv, as well as NPR's Greg Myrie talking to us from Washington. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Scott.
All right. The IRS is laying off thousands of workers this week, right in the middle of a busy tax filing season. The job cuts are part of a much larger downsizing effort that Elon Musk and his team are carrying out all across the federal government. The widespread layoffs are supposed to save money for the government, but cutbacks at the tax collection agency could actually have the opposite effect. NPR's Scott Horsley is here to explain. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
All right, so tell us more. What is happening at the IRS exactly?
Employees at the tax collection agency were told this morning that more than 6,000 jobs are being eliminated this week. That's more than 6% of the agency's total workforce. Neither Elon Musk's team nor the White House have provided a lot of detail about which jobs are being cut or why, but we understand most of the affected workers are probationary, which usually means they've been in their current position for a fairly short period of time. And at the IRS, there are quite a few probationary workers because the agency has been hiring aggressively in the last couple of years to improve customer service and to go after wealthy tax cheats. That hiring push has been a real partisan football, though, and that may be part of what's playing out here.
Interesting. Okay, wait, step back. What are the politics around staffing at the IRS?
For more than a decade, Republicans made a steady drive to starve the IRS of resources. And, you know, frankly, the tax collector made a fairly easy political target. Mm-hmm. But as funding dried up, it became harder and harder for taxpayers to get their questions answered, for example. At one point, 9 out of 10 telephone calls to the IRS were going unanswered. Mm-hmm. And tax enforcement also dropped off, especially for rich people who could more easily hide their income. We wound up with what critics call a two-tiered tax system where millionaires were less likely to be audited than the working poor. All of this began to turn around in 2022 after congressional Democrats approved a big increase of IRS funding, $80 billion over a decade. Republicans later clawed back at least a quarter of that money, but the investment did start to pay off. You know, phone calls were being answered again. Millionaires were starting to get more tax scrutiny. Susan Long, who tracks IRS audits at Syracuse University, says she's disappointed to see that progress set back now because of these layoffs.
I just shook my head sadly. It's just so counterproductive. If your goal is to save money and be efficient, this is not what any rational person would do.
Now, the administration is defending the IRS job cuts. Kevin Hassett, who heads the president's National Economic Council, says the U.S. still has plenty of tax collectors. And anyway, he says the IRS cuts are a small part of the overall government layoffs.
Okay, so cutting jobs would reduce the government's payroll, but as we mentioned, it could backfire, right? So explain that more.
Well, the IRS is by far the government's biggest moneymaker, or at least biggest money collector, and every dollar the IRS spends on tax enforcement pays for itself many times over. Mm-hmm. So Natasha Sirin, who is an advisor on tax policy in the Biden administration, says whatever salary savings may result from these layoffs, they'll be dwarfed by the lost revenue.
What you're doing is making it harder for us to make progress on waste, fraud, and abuse, making the system more inequitable, and ultimately costing trillions of dollars in tax revenue that is owed to the government, but just is uncollected.
Now, the union representing IRS workers is asking a judge to halt these job cuts, and right now the judge is thinking about that.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
A measles outbreak in West Texas is growing rapidly, and with kindergarten vaccination rates dipping, more communities may be at risk of outbreaks. But it is not just kids who should be vaccinated. Some adults may need a booster, too. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
Measles is one of the world's most contagious diseases. Dr. Paul Offit is director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He says, just look at the current outbreak in West Texas.
I mean, started, you hear about 14 cases, then you heard about 24 cases, then you have about 48 cases, now you have about 58 cases. They keep saying it's under control, but it's very hard to control measles.
Now, the best defense against measles is vaccination. The vast majority of people getting sick are unvaccinated, and the measles vaccine is safe and highly effective. Here's Dr. William Schaffner of Vanderbilt University.
If you have been vaccinated with two doses of vaccine as per routine, you have a 95%+ chance of being completely protected throughout your life.
But there are some adults who should consider getting another measles shot.
There are some concerns about people who were vaccinated before 1968 with a killed version of this vaccine, which didn't work very well.
He says people who got those early vaccines should get revaccinated. And if you're not sure of your vaccination status, there's no harm in getting another shot.
You will boost your immunity to not only measles, but German measles and mumps, because all of those three are in one vaccine.
If you were vaccinated between 1968 and 1989, you likely received just one dose instead of the two that are standard today. Dr. Adam Ratner is a pediatric infectious disease specialist in New York City. He says in most cases, that one dose is considered enough protection. But there are exceptions.
If you're traveling somewhere where there's an active outbreak and you're not sure that you got two doses, it may not be crazy to get a second dose.
If you live in a place that's experiencing an outbreak, your local health department may recommend a second dose for adults. And Offit says vaccination is the best way to protect children.
I lived through the 1991 Philadelphia measles epidemic, where there were 1,400 cases and 9 deaths over a period of 3 months. So I've seen children suffer needlessly because of the choice not to get a vaccine. So please vaccinate your children.
Maria Godoy, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Juana Summers in Nuuk, Greenland, where President Trump's calls for the U.S. to take over the territory have sparked alarm and outrage. Denmark, which is responsible for Greenland's security, recently announced that it would further boost its defense spending. Last week, lawmakers on Capitol Hill held a hearing focused on Trump's ambitions. In Greenland, Naya Nathanielson was watching. She's running for parliament in next month's elections, and I met her at her office in Nuuk earlier today. On one wall next to her desk, a piece of art caught my eye. It's an illustration of the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, gavel in hand. On the lectern, the words, "Fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you." I started by asking Naya Nathanielson for her reaction when she heard Trump's goal to take over her country, which she learned of when seeing a post from Trump's Truth Social platform.
Well, I read a social media post the 23rd of December. I actually took it much more serious, and I think also I got this feeling that this is going to be something we're going to be debating for a long time.
What was it about what he said and what he's been saying that made you take it more seriously?
I think it was use of control and ownership, which had rendered a more serious vibe to it, if you will. And also, I think since then, I've seen more and more people come out with similar stances and different suggestions, some in form of memes, some in form of just social media posts, some in form of op-eds in serious papers, now latest a Senate hearing, right? So I think it has degrees of seriousness to it now that it didn't have the last time around.
I don't know how much of that Senate hearing you were able to see or digest, but what do you make of some of the arguments coming out of the states? There are a number of bills moving through our government suggesting authorizing the President Trump to go into negotiations to purchase Greenland, suggesting a recent bill suggesting Greenland being renamed as Red, White, and Blue Land. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, first of all, I watched the Senate hearing and I was quite offended by the idea that we are a commodity for sale. Yeah. People forget that we are actually a people. We are a people in our own right with our own culture. We don't want to be Americans. That does not mean we don't want to trade with America or have connections to America, but we are not Americans. So I think it's offending on many levels and shows a lack of insight. Also in diplomacy, I think, because I don't believe in this bullying tactic. I don't think that's a way to gain true allies and true partnerships. And I think it's a very short-term way of trying to get your way. History has shown us that is not a way to obtain lasting peace.
I think if President Trump or a member of his administration or an ally were sitting here, they'd make the case that the interest that the U.S. has in Greenland is rooted in Arctic security and the strategic location of this island. What do you make of the security-based argument? Of course, the countries have had relationships for a long time. The United States has had and still has a military base here. What do you make of that?
Well, we've been all along saying we have an over 80-year long relationship with the U.S., and we do recognize we're part of the American interest fair in terms of national security. And we've been pushing for many years now the idea to have more monitoring of the Arctic, both in submarine and in the air. So we don't oppose that. But again, it does not follow from that what we want to be American or that the U.S. needs ownership of Greenland to obtain these goals. It is absolutely possible without the use of force or threats or acquirement.
I'm curious, what kind of relationship would you like to see between our two countries moving forward? We have that decades-long history. What is a way that there could be a relationship between Greenland and the U.S. that benefits the Greenlandic people who live here? What would you say?
I think just rewind like 8 months, because we had a good relationship. We had a memorandum of understanding that we wanted to expand on mineral exploration. And we also wanted to discuss further military presence in Greenland in terms of installations that could have dual use so both benefiting military purposes, but also the people of Greenland. We had a good relationship, and we were positive towards both American investments and collaboration, and that has been pretty hard hit the last couple of months.
You're saying we had a good relationship, we had good opinions. That is in the past tense. Can you just paint a picture for us of what this has done for people here, for their views of Americans, for their views of the relationship with America?
A lot of people are struggling to remind themselves that America also has good people, that we have friends in America, that America is an ally, because frankly, the last couple of months have shown an America that is a bad ally, that is a bully, that doesn't respect our democracy, that doesn't respect our government, that treat us as a commodity, that seems indifferent to what the Greenlandic people want. And that is both hurtful and frightening, because we are a micro state. We are such a small population. We totally rely on a good relationship with a big partner. So for us, it has really damaged, I think, our relationship. And I think it's very sad, because we have so much to gain from each other. I think it was an open door. There was absolutely no barriers towards American interest into Greenland just a couple of months ago.
That was Naya Nathanielson. She's running for parliament and has served as Minister of Business, Trade, Mineral Resources, Justice, and Gender Equality in the Greenlandic government.
Renowned urban planning professor Donald Shoup died earlier this month. He was an emeritus professor at UCLA, and even if you'd never taken a class with him, you may have experience with the thing he studied. Parking.
That's right. If you have ever driven a car, then you know that feeling of sweet victory when you find the perfect free parking spot, right? Well, that free spot comes with a hidden cost, according to Shoup, who was one of the world's foremost experts in land economics and parking.
Shoup's landmark book, The High Cost of Free Parking, is some 700 pages, but his humor and accessible writing amassed him a dedicated following among urban planners, government officials, and activists. Here he is talking with NPR's Jennifer Ludden in 2005.
I think that parking is important for all of you, that the average car is parked 95% of the time, and some of your listeners were probably even conceived in a parked car.
In the book, Shoup argues that free parking causes all kinds of negative effects in urban areas, and the real cost of parking is all around us.
It's hidden in the prices for everything that we buy, or it's hidden in the price of housing and the price of restaurant meals or merchandise at stores. I think a little bit of everything we pay for is siphoned off to pay for the parking that seems free.
The book became a classic in urban planning circles, and his policy ideas have been adopted worldwide. According to the Parking Reform Network, over 3,000 cities around the world have put some of Shoup's proposals into place.
But, you know, beyond his ideas, Shoup was a celebrated member of the UCLA community and often biked to campus from his home. Shoup's fans, who call themselves Shoupistas, knew him as UCLA's parking guru and a parking rock star.
They called him Shoup Dog, a nickname he happily embraced. He was 86 years old.
This is NPR News.
The United States has sent more than 100 migrants to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Our correspondent learned of a WhatsApp group where the migrants' relatives try to share information.
One of the messages read, "I'm just a mother who needs to know that my son is okay."
Desperate messages. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. You know that human instinct to reach out and help someone who's hurt?
Turns out we might share that with other creatures, like mice.
To me, this looks very much like a behavior that's driven by what I would call the altruistic impulse.
Aw, we'll explain after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has voted to confirm Kash Patel as the new director of the FBI. Patel's controversial nomination was pushed over the line despite fierce opposition from Democrats. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The Republican-led Senate confirmed Patel by a vote of 51-49 to lead the FBI, the nation's most powerful law enforcement agency. Two Republican senators, Maine's Susan Collins and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, joined all Senate Democrats in opposition. Patel is a former prosecutor and was a national security official in Trump's first term. He's also a Trump loyalist and fierce critic of the FBI. His Republican supporters say he will fix what they argue is the politicization of the FBI against conservatives. Patel's critics, meanwhile, say he lacks the necessary experience and temperament to lead the Bureau, and worry that he will use the FBI's vast powers to make good on his repeated threats to go after his and Trump's perceived enemies. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Mexico's president is warning the Trump administration against any invasion of its territory. NPR's Ada Peralta reports this comes as the U.S. designated six Mexican cartels as terrorist groups.
The U.S. now considers some of Mexico's biggest organized crime groups terrorists. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said this was a decision the U.S. took unilaterally. She said Mexico, like the U.S., is committed to fighting drug cartels, but through cooperation, not coercion.
Esta no puede ser una oportunidad.
This designation, she said, cannot be used by the U.S. as an opportunity to undermine our sovereignty. Sheinbaum then proposed changes to the Mexican Constitution that explicitly say the Mexican people reject foreign interventions or violation of Mexico's territory by land, sea, or air. President Trump has floated the idea of bombing the Mexican drug cartel.
This is NPR. The popular James Bond franchise will now be controlled by Amazon MGM Studios. Until now, the brand had been under the control of one family for more than 60 years. As NPR's Andrew Limbong tells us, the last James Bond film in 2021 was no time to die.
Sibling movie producers Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson were behind casting Daniel Craig as James Bond, redefining the character for the 21st century, starting with 2006's Casino Royale.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
Now they're handing creative control over to Amazon. In a statement, Amazon MGM Studios chief Mike Hopkins wrote that they, quote, look forward to ushering in the next phase of the legendary 007 for audiences around the world. No Time to Die was Craig's last go as Bond. No word yet on who will take up the mantle, but Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has already taken to social media to ask for suggestions. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Trump administration is launching a review of money spent on California's long-delayed high-speed rail line. It's a project supported by Democrats and loathed by Republicans who say it's an example of wasted money. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy made the announcement today at LA's Union Station, saying they will be looking into how federal money has been used on the project, which is this is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Senator Mitch McConnell announced his retirement earlier today on the Senate floor. The Kentucky Republican was the longest-serving Republican leader in Senate history and one of the most consequential politicians of the modern era. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis joins us now. Hey there.
Hey, Scott.
So what did McConnell say about his decision to retire?
Well, today is his 83rd birthday, but he noted that he made this decision last year. And I would say none of this comes as a surprise in Capitol Hill. After McConnell announced last year that he would step down as majority leader, it seemed clear that he was not preparing to run for re-election next year. And physically, he's had a hard couple of years. He suffered injuries from several falls, including one that required hospitalization back in 2023. Just earlier this month, he had another fall that required the use of a wheelchair. Politically, I'd say McConnell's also had a hard couple of years. He is someone who has gone from being one of the party's most powerful players to someone who is increasingly on the outside in President Trump's party, and especially with the MAGA movement.
He is often described in recent years the way I described him in the introduction, this consequential figure. What do you think his legacy is going to be?
I think if you ask Mitch McConnell, he will say clearly that he thinks without question it was his decision to block President Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland from going through the confirmation process. That was back in March of 2016. And McConnell sort of single-handedly orchestrated that strategy. It was a bit of an accidental gamble, but it also paid off because that blockade helped rally evangelical Christian voters around Donald Trump. They were very skeptical of him. And he used that vacancy to promise to appoint conservative justices to the court, which had been a top issue. And Trump credits that with his victory. Mm-hmm. And the rest is, you know, Scott, it's history. Trump won. It paid off. McConnell's almost singularly responsible for Trump's ability to put Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court and ultimately shift the court towards conservatives for potentially a very long time.
There's this interesting dynamic that McConnell is this key figure in the political rise and success of Donald Trump in his legacy. And yet these two men hold each other in low regard. They have almost no relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure you could find two more contrasting personalities among leaders in the same party. McConnell has always been about restraint, about strategy. He regards himself as the Senate institutionalist. You even recall there was this brief moment in time after the January 6th attack on the Capitol that McConnell appeared to be entertaining the possibility of voting to convict Trump. And if you think about it, had he tried and rallied Republicans to join him, a conviction would have barred Trump from ever seeking office again.
Right.
Ultimately, McConnell did not do that. He did support Trump's re-election. But the Republican Party, to understate it, is moving away from that McConnell-Ronald Reagan-era worldview, particularly on matters of foreign policy. McConnell today in his remarks remained rock-rib in his view that the U.S. should have a robust foreign intervention policy. He continues to back the U.S. support in Ukraine in their fight against Russia. He said he would continue to press that message in his final time in the Senate. But Trump is obviously leading the party in another more isolationist direction, and it seems pretty clear that rank-and-file Republicans are prepared to follow Trump's lead now.
That is NPR political correspondent Susan Davis. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Social media is rife with false health claims. Claims like your food is poisoning you, or that six-week-old raw milk is safe to drink. These claims are often promoted by wellness influencers who are peddling supplements along with these sensational statements. But as NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports, some scientists and pro-science influencers are trying to fight back.
Mallory DeMille wants more people to be skeptical of wellness influencers. She's a social media specialist with a background in marketing, and in her spare time, she uses those skills to make snarky TikTok and Instagram videos highlighting how some influencers promote unproven remedies and use multi-level marketing ploys known as MLMs.
Okay, the game today is guess the MLM, and guess how much is preloaded into this cart link thing.
In this video, DeMille is taking on a post by an influencer who promotes essential oils.
I personally would love to know why she's recommending five $100 worth of doTERRA oils for cancer.
The influencer didn't respond to a request for comment, but her website has a disclaimer that says she doesn't provide medical advice or treatment. In other videos, DeMille does handstands while she jokes about the mental gymnastics behind many wellness influencers' talking points.
First, Big Pharma is keeping you sick to take your money, but also give me your money and take my supplements indefinitely.
DeMille is part of a growing group of social media creators trying to counteract unproven wellness claims online. When a popular post claims some baby formulas have high fructose corn syrup and suggested Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services, could ban it, Jessica Nurek went to Instagram to set the record straight.
Lots of people are revved up and ready to go. Let's go, RFK Jr. Get that high fructose corn syrup out of formula. There's only one problem. Not a single infant formula in the entire United States includes high fructose corn syrup.
Nurek has a PhD in nutrition science and is a registered dietitian. Lately, she dedicates a lot of her time to social media, where she has more than 860,000 followers between Instagram and TikTok. Nurek says she's all for a wellness-focused lifestyle. She even identifies as old-school crunchy herself. The problem, she says,
it's really this social media wellness space that is using a lot of fear-based, conspiratorial, anti-science language, taking advantage of people to then sell them supplements and other wellness solutions.
Over the past several months, many of these influencers have also been promoting Kennedy and his Make America Healthy Again, or MAHA, campaign. And Kennedy has raised their profile, too.
RFK Jr., a lot of his talking points are the same talking points that wellness influencers use.
And since Kennedy spent years spreading vaccine misinformation before becoming the country's top health official, and federal health programs are now being slashed, scientists say the stakes just got even higher for counteracting false health claims online. Yet research suggests algorithms on popular social media sites can guide users toward extreme and sensationalized content rather than nuanced information. That's one of the many reasons it's hard for scientists to become successful influencers. Not to mention, it usually doesn't pay the bills.
Most science communicators aren't selling you a myriad of supplements and wellness solutions at, you know, like a 50% markup.
Another concern, online harassment is common against people who advocate for vaccines and against ideas popularized by wellness influencers. Still, scientists need to be on social media because that's where people are going for health information, says Caitlin Jedalina, a public health expert who runs Your Local Epidemiologist, a health newsletter and website. Jedalina says people don't just want facts. They want storytellers and narrators they can connect with.
Scientists are never taught how to do this, right? So we're kind of catching up to influencers out there and understanding what works and what doesn't work.
And what is clear is that health information on social media, whether it's from influencers or experts, will keep playing a bigger and bigger role in how we think about health. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says she will not force New York City's embattled Mayor Eric Adams from office. Her decision is a big win for Adams, of course, and a victory for President Trump, who will now keep a key ally in charge of America's largest city. Instead, Hochul announced this afternoon that she will try to create new guardrails around Adams as he faces growing legal and political controversy. NPR's Brian Mann joins us now from Manhattan. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so let me get this straight. Governor Hochul was making it pretty clear that she was seriously considering pushing Adams out, right? But obviously, she decided against that. What do you think her thinking was?
You know, Elsa, a growing number of Democrats are pushing Hochul hard to have her remove Adams. But speaking today, she said first she believes voters should take the lead deciding Adams' fate. And she also said initiating a removal process could be harmful for the city.
I also have concerns about disruption and chaos
that such a move, such a proceeding could bring to the residents of this great city. It's not impossible that we'd have a scenario where there's multiple mayors of this city in the course of 1 year.
So, as you mentioned, Elsa, instead of removing Adams, Hochul says she's going to create these guardrails, meaning new oversight mechanisms, trying to give state officials more leverage over the city's future actions.
But what kind of leverage will state officials have compared to the leverage that the Trump administration might have, right? Because there are critics who say the Trump administration suspended this federal corruption case against Adams so that the White House would have leverage over him. And because it's just suspended, they can threaten to bring back those charges at any time. Am I understanding this correctly?
You got it exactly right. The Trump administration officials have been really clear. They expect Adams to play a big role helping the White House find and round up migrants without legal status, despite New York City's status as a sanctuary city. In recent weeks, Adams has already allowed federal immigration police to operate at the city's jail complex on Rikers Island. Adams himself appeared on Fox News with Trump's border czar, Tom Homan. And during that appearance, Homan actually warned Adams that he's expected to do a lot more.
If he doesn't come through, I'll be back in New York City, right, and we won't be sitting on a couch. I'll be in his office, up his butt, saying, where the hell is the agreement we came to?
Many Democrats here say that shows Adams is going to be under Donald Trump's thumb because of the threat of those criminal charges.
Wow. Okay, so did Hochul talk about that part of Adams' situation today?
She did. She says New York City is facing what she calls a grave threat from Trump, one that could include coercion.
Given how aggressive the Trump administration has been and how deeply disturbing the comments from the president's border czar were, we know they'll stop at nothing to try and exercise control over New York.
So Hochul says leaving Adams in place doesn't mean she's ducking a fight with the Trump administration, but this decision's going to be controversial.
Okay, well, there is one more thing, because we're waiting on a federal judge to decide whether those corruption charges against Adams will actually be dropped. What are you hearing?
Yeah, Judge Dale Ho hasn't issued his ruling yet. He promised to move quickly, but the DOJ's decision to shelve these charges so that Adams can help the White House on immigration, it's incredibly controversial. At least 7 DOJ attorneys have already resigned, saying this is a dangerous precedent. So as we wait for Ho's ruling, one other question now is whether Adams can rebuild his political support. He's seeking a second term, and Elsa, the Democratic primary is just 4 months away.
That is NPR's Brian Mann in Manhattan. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Elsa.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Tonight, Canada will play the United States in the final of the Four Nations Face-Off. The tournament is a replacement for this year's All-Star Game and features NHL players from Canada, Finland, Sweden, and the U.S. Now, if you're a fan of hockey, then you know about the dominance that Canada has had, both in the NHL and globally. But some fans say that is shifting because of one position, the goalie. Just 26% of goalies in the NHL these days are Canadian. In 1994, it was 73%, according to The Athletic. Dan Robson is a writer for The Athletic, and he says there is a lot at stake in tonight's rivalry, especially for Canada, who he writes is starting to lose its edge in the net. He's here now speaking to us from the TD Garden in Boston, where the championship will be played tonight. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to dig into the goalies, but let's start with this final and all of the tension and drama going into it. How big of a deal has this tournament and this championship become?
Well, you know, I think it kind of took everyone by surprise from the start. I don't think anyone really knew what to make of it, but it's taken on a life of its own. And I think this final, in terms of the buzz, certainly in Canada, where I'm from, it's up there at the Olympic level.
Well, let's shift gears then. If there's any one position on the ice that can set the tone of a game and pull a team over the line, it's the goalie. Canada for so long has been the goalie country. What has been going on? Why has that edge gone away?
You know, it's a position that Canada particularly sort of reigned supreme in. There was a French-Canadian style of goaltending, the butterfly style, that rose up to the 90s. And goaltenders like Patrick Waugh, who were sort of, you know, viewed as the greatest of all time, kind of established it. And everyone kind of followed that mold. But what we've seen in the last 15 years or so is a rise of particularly European goalies, but increasingly American goalies. So we tried to look into that, and really it comes down to, it looks like a systemic problem within the Canadian system, whereas other systems in Europe and in Russia and America, they've been able to find a way to really, you know, fine-tune that position and gain great success through it.
First, I just have to, as somebody who grew up a Devils fan, we can't talk about great Canadian, French-Canadian goalies and not mention Martin Brodeur in passing here, so I've checked that very important box. But what, is it something in the broader youth development system? Is it the way that goalies are trained? Like, what's changed?
It really comes down to a rigid system. From the experts that we spoke to, and we went sort of looked back at what was different about the Canadian system and the U.S. system, and this happens in other sports as well, but the competitiveness of minor hockey in Canada is through the roof. And what happens there, experts argue, is that we almost stunt the ability for young players to develop properly. The goaltending position is something that you excel at later in your career. It's obviously like the best athletes kind of become that position. We've seen that with goaltenders that we see now who are much more athletic and and capable of reacting. And in Canada, what we have is a very prescriptive model where that position is so focused at a young age on, you know, being on a top team and playing well at that age, that it's not giving room for the growth that excelling in athleticism requires, because it's such an ingrained system.
Is there one set idea of this is what we could do to start to turn this around, or is it still an ongoing conversation?
It's an ongoing conversation. I mean, I think when we look at what Sweden did in the past, I mean, Sweden looked at the goaltending position as a smaller nation and as a position that they might be able to find some advantages in because they didn't have the population. And they looked to sort of say, we can, you know, this is an area where we might be able to find some advancements. And they did excel greatly. And I think that what Canada is doing is looking at that and realizing that they had much more structure in their system to be able to sort of implement a top-down approach. Yeah. And in Canada, there's sort of a there's sort of a commerce of goaltending coaches and all kinds of experts in this position where there isn't sort of a cohesive way to implement a system. So it's going to be really difficult to shift, and I don't think it's going to be something that can happen overnight. I think you're going to continue to see a decline in top Canadian goaltenders for years to come, or several years to come, until fundamentally there's a change in how we produce goaltenders in Canada.
That's Dan Robson, a writer with The Athletic. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
When we humans encounter an unconscious person, we might spring into action and try to revive them. Well, a new study in the journal Science hints that lab mice might do something similar. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
Neuroscientist Li Zhang has anesthetized a lot of mice for his research. Several years ago, as he brought these knocked-out mice back to their cages, he started noticing that the mice around them were acting strangely.
Then we noticed, okay, then its cage mate has shown very strong social interaction with this anesthetized partner.
At first, the mouse would just sniff its cage mate. But as the cagemate remained unresponsive, the behaviors would escalate to things that seemed almost like first aid, says Zhang's colleague at the University of Southern California, Huizhong Wit Tao.
No behaviors like this has been reported before.
The fact that lab mice seem to be doing this offered a rare opportunity to study this in more detail. First, the team presented a subject mouse with an unconscious cagemate or an active mouse. The subject mouse spent a lot more time engaging with the anesthetized mouse.
So it seems that the mouse can perform deliberately this whole set of behaviors, escalating from sniffing, grooming, to more forceful actions such as tongue biting, mouth biting, and tongue pulling.
Those behaviors turned out to help the mice regain consciousness. When mice pulled out the tongues of their cage mates, that actually expanded the airways of the unconscious mouse and helped dislodge foreign objects that the researchers had placed there. What's more, it turned out that mice didn't just help any old mouse, but favored helping mice that they knew.
Familiarity is a very important factor, so it plays a major role.
These results led the researchers to think that maybe the mice are actually trying to help their friends. But they also might just be curious. To test that possibility, they repeated the experiment over 5 days. It turned out that the mice actually became a bit more interested in their unconscious cage mates over that time period.
This type of experiment can exclude the possibility of curiosity as a driving force.
Finally, the researchers studied the mouse's brains and found that oxytocin circuits were crucial for the behavior. Oxytocin plays a key role in helping behaviors across all sorts of animals. Altogether, Tao and Zhang say that the evidence supports the idea that the mice are actually trying to help their friends, even perhaps out of a sense of empathy. Peggy Mason, a neuroscientist at the University of Chicago, isn't so convinced.
They found a great behavior. I don't dispute that. I dispute the interpretation of it.
Specifically, she doesn't buy that the mice actually intend to help. She offers this analogy.
So if I drop $20 by mistake, somebody else picks it up, that person has been helped, but I have not helped them.
She thinks that curiosity about this weird unconscious mouse could still be driving these behaviors. But James Burkett, a neuroscientist at the University of Toledo, thinks that it might be an instinctual helping behavior.
To me, this looks very much like a behavior that's driven by what I would call the altruistic impulse.
The fact that even lab mice might be behaving in this altruistic way suggests to him that the inner lives of many animals may be much richer than humans have realized. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John...
A little swing can do more than anything else for you. Swing out, swing in. It's not a sin. So let's begin. You'll never get the gate if your swinging is up today. When your one and only complains that he's lonely and blue, your rhythmical campaign can do more than champagne to see him through.